This is Leave Your Mark. I'm Vince Cortez, and today's guest is Mr. Van Stacks. He is a breast cancer survivor. In 2013, he received his first cancer diagnosis in April 2013. He has a mastectomy. After enjoying 6 years of remission in October 2019, he started feeling lethargic at a family reunion. He has his second surgery along with chemotherapy then in April 2020. In December 2020, during his six-month checkup, the cancer was back and he would have his third surgery and radiation in January of 2021. As of April 29th, 2021, he is now cancer-free and he is our guest here today.
Hi there, and welcome. Now it's time for America's favorite podcast, Leave Your Mark, with your host, Vince Cortez.
If it's fly, loose fit it, it's Cortez. If freeze and chub is in it, it's Cortez.
Leave Your Mark is about inspiring the world, one guest at a time.
Pass the word from Brooklyn to Pittsburgh, from urban to suburb, it's Cortez, you heard?
And here is our host, Vince Cortez.
Vince, thank you for being here.
How you doing, Vince?
I'm doing great. I'm really glad you came by. You have a very interesting story. First and foremost, it's not commonly known that men get breast cancer.
And yes, sir.
So this is, you know, right away, it's going to grip our attention here as to why and how all it took place. But before we get into the details of your cancer, I want to share with the audience where you were born and raised and what life was like when you're a youngster. So everything starts out here in Memphis, Tennessee, born and raised. And you're still in Memphis, aren't you?
I am. Yes, I am.
I think that smile shows it. People in Memphis have a lot of joy and it's a nice neighborhood. So that smile is recognizable to Memphis, I believe. Your mother and father, you got Van Stack Sr. and he was in janitorial services. And your mom, Gloria Hanna, she was a pastry chef. And you had three brothers, of which you were the oldest.
Yes.
Travis, Tredarius, and Carlos. Share with me what childhood was like with mom and dad and your three brothers.
We lived with mom, and it was me and Carlos with my mom. And the other two brothers are half-brothers by my father. But we all grew up together and looked out for one another. But it was me and Carlos. We back in the day, we used to have this thing when we go to church, who sung the best, me or him? So it would be so funny, especially on the days when it was only me and him as the tenors in the choir, and he's trying to outsing me and I'm trying to outsing him, and the altos and sopranos are going, okay, could y'all bring it down? So it was just a competition, a friendly competition that we had at church. Who could sing better? I won all the time, of course. You know.
Of course you did. Of course you did. So you were mentioning that you had a lot of church and you were doing the family, the Bible schools and so forth like that. So moving forward and taking that, what was your greatest experience from Bible school that you still use today?
I am a preacher by nature, and I had some advice from my grandfather when I first started preaching, and he told me two great things that I use all the time. And it is like, and the night before I went to preach my first sermon, he sat me down in the living room and he said, "Grandson, I have two very important pieces of information that you're going to need as a preacher." He said, "Don't make the people happy twice." I said, "Huh?" He said, "Don't make the people happy twice. Happy to see you get up and happy to see you sit down."
Pearls of wisdom.
I use that to this day. And then he said, "Aim high, strike fire, and sit down." In other words, preach what you're going to preach, say what you're going to say, and sit down. And I still use that to this day as well.
This kind of a background and having that solid church going, now you go off into high school, you're at Central High School Memphis Warriors, proud graduate of class 89, And you're in the show choir, and this is an award-winning choir. So this had already started with you and Carlos at church. So
right.
Now it's getting official. So share with me how that went down when you were at the show choir.
When I got in high school, I did not know what group I wanted to join. There were all kinds of groups, chess club, homemakers club. I mean, all kinds of organizations. But once I saw my first year in the 10th grade, I saw the actual show choir perform. And I met the teacher by the name of Miss Minter. She showed us a lot of love during class. It wasn't just the learning of the music. She got involved in our personal lives. She made sure that we had what we need to be successful in class. So not only did she teach us music, but she taught us how to be prepared for life. And she's dead and gone now, but I do remember her, and I want to honor her by calling her name, Miss Minter. She was a great teacher, not only, like I said, in the classroom, but outside the classroom as well.
Yeah, when you take them with you and they become a part of you, that's the best kind of teacher you can possibly have. So now you're a high school graduate, and you get on with work with the police service technicians. Share with me what a police service technician does and how that began the direction of your working career.
Here in Memphis, we have a program with the Memphis Police Department that you can join the police department right out of high school. But here in Memphis, you have a requirement to have so many hours of college, I think 2 years of college, before you can become a Memphis police officer. So what happens is Memphis Police Department allow you to apply at the age of 18. And once you graduate, you go to the training academy for 6 weeks of training. Only thing you're learning in training is traffic detail, traffic, how to direct traffic, traffic accidents, traffic laws, and all of that stuff. So once you graduate from the academy, you go to the street and you become a PST, which is an acronym for a police service technician. Anything traffic, we did it. Accidents, traffic control, for the Grizzly games, for downtown graduations. We were the ones actually doing the traffic control. We drove white cars with yellow lights. And we had the police department as our backup. So if we ran into an accident and a suspect had suspended license, we'll allow the notify the dispatcher, and the dispatcher will send the police to come and issue that person a citation or take them into custody.
Now, is that service still exists? Because that's sort of a breather, because I think in our society today, the idea of the police showing up on a scene isn't always a rescue. And, you know, the idea that you guys intervene before the police should show up kind of serves as that buffer, maybe to make those people feel more comfortable.
They stopped the program under our last director. They stopped it for about 5 or 6 years, but under the new director, they brought it back. It's a great public service tool to free up the police officers to handle other crimes, but also it trains that PST or that police service technician, because I didn't have a gun on. So I went to a scene where there were two people arguing about who's at fault. I don't have a badge. I don't have a gun. But here I come to show up as the authority figure, and I'm going to decide who's at fault or who did what, who caused the accident. So it taught you how to deal with citizens without using force. We have a thing called verbal judo. When they start getting mad at you, you kind of calm them down just by not going to that level, because one, you don't have a gun, and two, your backup is maybe far away or handling a robbery or something. So you have to learn how to use the gift of gab to talk people down. So it was a great tool for the PSTs that we took over to policing, and we had less problems with people because we knew how to talk to people, how to respect people. We knew the rights of people because we had to learn those things before getting a gun, and that our mouth was the piece to talk us out of in the
situation. I like it. I think that that should be advocated in more cities. Now, you go on to become a police officer after all this. You get the education, you get for the 2 years, you qualify. Now you go into the police academy. Share with me what that felt like, where it was official and now you were going to be carrying a gun and the business was going to get much more serious.
Well, even as a police officer, I went in working in certain neighborhoods. I worked in a very poor neighborhood. And I remember my FTO, when I first came out, her name was Carolyn Woods. And she was my first FTO. And she worked in 720, we worked in 721's ward, which is in Memphis, Tennessee. It's Riverside, close to downtown, but in the South Memphis area of town, which is kind of a rough area of town. She taught me compassion for the people. If we saw a car and the car had, we call them may pops, that your tire may pop at any moment. So they may have four may pops on their car, and you're going to write them a $95 ticket. And you see that they have bad tires on their car, a busted out window, bad registration. Are you going to write that person a $95 ticket, or are you going to be compassionate and say, hey, next time I stop you, you need to have this done? And she taught me how to be compassionate to the people that we serve. And then that worked out for me in the long run, because when I needed information of a murder or a suspect, those people that I gave breaks to were the ones that called me and said, hey, he's hiding out in apartment number 4. He's hiding out in apartment number 5. So all of the PST and having a good FTO teaches you about compassion.
Wow. You're going on a much deeper level there with police service work that needs to be made more known than it is, because it's really about serving, protecting the people, and you're giving them the opportunity of serving them and protecting them to the max with your approach and your compassion.
If I can tell you this story, which sometimes you need a thank you to let you know that you're on the right track and you're on the right path and you're doing the right job. There was an old elderly woman that lived next to a home of an elderly man. But the elderly man had 4 grandsons that had turned his home into a drug trap house. So we would go by there every day and talk to this old lady, and she was just tired. She would wake up every morning picking up beer bottles, beer cans, all kinds of stuff out of her yard from where the people came overnight and threw it in her yard from the next door neighbors. So we finally went into the house where the 4 men were and found out that their grandfather was way in the back, bedridden. So he did not know what they were doing in this home. And we finally got those guys arrested and moved. And this 80-some-year-old woman, in her feeble handwriting, wrote our mayor about how we changed her neighborhood. And from that, I knew I was doing the right thing and I was in the right job.
This is really nice.
Connect with us on LinkedIn. Be our friend on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram. Whether jumping out the MP or jumping on the app. You are listening to Vince Cortez. We just want you to leave your mark.
Now, you go on for a while here, and 22 years in the law enforcement, and you have a hiccup here, so to speak. And something completely unexpected, it redirects your wife. What happened?
As a police officer, I was off duty and I had a DUI. And that DUI changed the direction of my plans. I became angry with God because I stayed in the church. I gave to the community. I did everything right I thought I was supposed to do. So how am I in this predicament? And then I found out from the accident, I went to the hospital, had a chest x-ray, and they found a little small black dot in my breast area. So I go to my first oncologist, and he does a needle biopsy and advised me that the knot is not cancerous. So I went on back home, and about 3 to 4 weeks later, the knot returned in the size of a walnut or an acorn. And you could touch it. It was very rubbery and hard. So I went back to my primary care physician and said, hey, look, now I can actually feel the knot. And he felt for it. He's okay. Well, I'm going to send you to another oncologist. So he sent me to another oncologist, and that oncologist confirmed that I had breast cancer. And when Dr. Coleman walked into the room, he said, Mr. Stash, you have breast cancer. I said an expletive to him, and I was like, man, stop playing with me. He said, you play too much. He said, no, Mr. Stacks, I'm very serious. You have breast cancer. And I think within 3 or 4 weeks, I was had my first mastectomy.
Now, you answered a couple of questions there I wanted to ask you. So your original thought was you drew up anger. What happened when you were alone after he was emphatic that you had the cancer and you were alone with your own thoughts? What was going through your mind at that point?
When I got home, because when I was at the doctor, they didn't leave me alone. The nurses were there. They, you know, because they saw that I was distraught in the face. Like, what, really? What? Breast cancer? Where did that come from? But when I got home, I wasn't really scared. I was confused that men could get breast cancer, but I trusted God. Mm-hmm. So, I think that's what kept me from not going through chemo and radiation as worse as it could have been, is because I trusted God.
Mm. You were dialed in, so your sense of security was much greater than most when they find out. So moving forward then, what then becomes your biggest challenges? Because this goes on for quite a while. So you have a mastectomy done, and then little would you know, that was actually the beginning of what a series of things that you would then go through. So what becomes your biggest challenge moving forward?
Again, so I had that first mastectomy. I enjoyed 6 years of remission, and I was at a family reunion in 2019, and breast cancer to me made me feel very lethargic. I could go to bed at 9 o'clock at night and wake up at 9 o'clock the next morning, and I would feel like I have not had any sleep.
Wow.
And so I was at the family reunion. I went to bed that night. I woke up the next morning. I was like, oh my God, I'm so tired. What is going on? And I told my family, I said, hey, I think my cancer's back. I said, I got to Memphis, I'm gonna check. And of course, I have a saved family. So they're like, oh, we rebuked that in the name of Jesus. No, don't say that. I said, no, I know my body. Something's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And got back to Memphis and went to West Cancer Center and found out that I was in stage 3. And my cancer had returned.
Were they going to treat you with the chemotherapy then? Like, when did that part of the process happen?
Oh, I'm getting to it.
Okay. And so
the second time, when I went to, for the second time, they found out I was had breast cancer again. I did another, my second mastectomy. And then this time they ordered 27 rounds of chemotherapy.
Mm.
So I did 27 rounds of chemotherapy. I was cancer-free, feeling great, going to aftercare and doing well. Went back for a checkup within 6 months and was just doing my 6 months checkup, kind of find out my cancer had returned in the same spot. And this time it had attached itself to my bone. I think it was the last time or this time, I can't remember which one, but one time it attached itself to my bone. And they were afraid that it was going to metastasize over my body. But but since I knew my body, we caught it in time.
Mm.
So I had a third mastectomy. And then we did 32 rounds of radiation.
Oh, wow.
And as of April 29th, 2021, I think, I was breast cancer free.
That's amazing. So you had over 50 treatments in those two rounds of chemo. How does your body feel now, like after going through all of that?
I'm going through something now called mastectomy pain syndrome. In the area that I receive my radiation, every now and then it lets me know that the wires are still alive. And the way my doctor explained it to me is like going into a house and you cut the wires that have fallen from the house are dead, but the wires that's still connected to the house are still alive, and every now and then they let you know that they're alive. And that's what it does. It's like somebody punched me in my chest, and I will have to go through this breathing regimen to just calm down. And so, and I didn't understand what was going on, and they finally diagnosed it as mastectomy pain syndrome. And a couple weeks ago, well, it's been about 4 or 5 weeks now, I had my first blood clot. Blood clots are a symptom of radiation. And I take a pill called tamoxifen. I have to take it for the next 5 years, and that also causes blood clots. And I had my first blood clot probably about 4 weeks ago. Spent about 4 or 5 days in the hospital dealing with that. Had two procedures to get it removed. So
Wow.
it's still a journey, but
Yeah, it'll still be a journey. Be careful with the medications because that's like your body has an instinctive healingness to it. So the idea of the medication either slowing it or interfering with that can be dangerous, even though it's supposed to be helping.
help them, right.
Now, I want to talk about some of these things that you've done here because God spoke to you more than just in a healing. You got off the bed and got into doing something about helping other people that are experiencing the same situation you have now. You sounded like you have started with your West was cancer care. And share with me what you did with that. And then you have a nonprofit, Pink Ain't What You Think. Yeah, I would like you to expand on that for me as well.
On my birthday, my friends threw me a surprise birthday party. And people came from all over everywhere. And it was a surprise. When I walked into the building, all of my friends were there. And one of my best friends, I call him my grandson, he gave me $300 for my birthday. He said, "Grandfather, here's $300 for you for your birthday. And here's $300 for your dream. You told me about your dream, how you want to help other cancer patients." He said, "I want to be the first to sow into your dream." And so when the room heard that I had a dream and he explained what I wanted and what was in my dream, when I woke up Monday morning, I had over $1,700 in my Cash App to start Pink Ain't What You Think. And ever since then, I have not stopped working. That Monday morning, we started Pink Ain't What You Think, and we went forward. We have four tiers of service at Pink Ain't What You Think. We offer free cremations to family members that die of cancer that don't have insurance. We offer that family a full cremation service. The only thing they're responsible for is flowers, programs, and death certificates. Our second tier is ultimate wishes. We give ultimate wishes to dying cancer patients or patients that have been put on hospice. If there's something that you want to do or something that you've always wanted to do, or you want to take your kids to a certain place before that day comes, we try to give you your ultimate wish before that day comes. Our third tier service is called Blankets of Love. I was going through cancer, chemo, and nobody told me how cold you would get going through chemotherapy. So this volunteer brought me a blanket and he told me it was his last blanket. So I immediately got on Facebook with my friends and said, "Hey, there's a need at West Cancer. We need blankets. Meet me at West Cancer from 12 to 1 and just drop off the little $5.99 fleece blankets because it makes a difference in a cancer patient's care." The first time we did it, we collected 395 blankets. And the second time I partnered with the Alpha Kappa Alphas here in Memphis, and we collected 895 blankets that time. And so every new cancer patient will get a blanket from us because it makes a difference in your treatment. just a $5.99 fleece blanket to a cancer patient going through chemo will change their entire experience. And our fourth tier of service is the Toys of Love, which we have every year in December. It's called Luncheon with Santa at the Memphis Fire Museum. We've partnered with the Memphis Fire Museum, and we bring kids of cancer patients. Your father or mother has to be actively going through chemo or radiation for us to service that family. And last year, we took care of 21 children, 21 families. This year, we took care of 47 families in-house in Memphis and 19 families outside of the state. And if she sent you those videos of those kids thanking us for their boxes of toys, we really packed the box down. Each kid got at least 20 to 30 pieces of toys from us from Memphis.
Oh, wow. Vince, this is an amazing story. Your empathy from your youth, as well as your experience in the Bible schools and camps and so forth, just play out in spades here. This is huge. You're doing so much for your community.
Me and my board, we thought that we were just having a toy drive. Last year, it was just a toy drive, and the kids came, and they got the toys. They got to meet Santa and the Five Dalmatian. This year, we invited some children that had lost their mother last year that came to our drive, and their mother wasn't with them. We invited them back with their surviving parent or grandparent. Wow. And then we invited other children, mother and father, that's going through stage 4 cancer now, and they were spending their last Christmas with their children. Those 9-year-old, 8-year-old, 10-year-olds got to meet other 9 and 10-year-olds that were about to lose their parents. We were in the corner crying and losing our mind. But those kids were so supportive of each other, and they were letting you know, okay, I lost my mom last year, but it's going to be okay. Here's my number. Call me. And we're looking like, oh, my God, these kids are creating a community within their own community of helping each other. You know, it was amazing to see. And again, last year, we thought we was just throwing a toy drive. This year, we found out that those 9 and 10-year-olds are the only caregiver at home. So when that 9-year-old go home and mother just went through chemo, mother's bedridden, that 9-year-old or 10-year-old has to fix his own meal, has to do his own homework, has to prepare bath water for mama because mama can barely walk from the bed to the And so that's why we just give, it's such important to us at Pink Ain't What You Think, to give those children a day of just normalcy where they're just children. And wow, to see those smiles and to see kids loving on each other and supporting each other through death and this horrible disease, these kids had to grow up to real fast.
Oh, I'll say.
I'm going to send you some pictures. And just to see the looks and the smiles on those kids' face, just to see Santa Claus, and we give them a bag, and they get to go down in a room and just pack that bag with any kind of toys, all the toys they want, and to see those smiles, it does so much for me.
Oh, I can tell.
And I'm so grateful. A lot of people say, why me? I don't. I say, thank you, God, because my wife said, if you want to make God laugh, you tell him what your plans are. And that's where I am now, because I planned to be a police officer all my life. But God took me in a whole nother direction. And I would not change the experience that I went through for nothing, because the people that I'm helping, it blows my mind to see how grateful they are for something just small as a blanket.
Vince, this is an incredible story. Never did you ever imagine that God was going to speak to you and provide this kind of joy through you.
If you have a story to share, tell us. How are you going to leave your mark? Contact us. Leave Your Mark with our host, Vince Cortez. Be our guest.
I had to ask you, how would you like to leave your mark? How would you like to be remembered?
You know, leaving this place a better place than I found it. I'm going to send you a video of Jasmine Smith. Jasmine Smith was our first, I don't know if she sent it to you or not, but she was our first Ultimate Award recipient. And we called her and asked her, what does she want to do? And the nurses called us back and told us that she wanted to go to the casino one last time. Excuse me, sir. I'm just... She wanted to go to the casino one last time. And so I called my board and told my board, hey, let's start making plans to get her and her family to Las Vegas. Let's go ahead and look for hotel rooms, flights, and everything. Let's do it ASAP because they just put on hospice yesterday. And so I called her the next day and let her know that, hey, this is what we're trying to do. And she said, oh, no, Mr. Stacks. She said, I want to go to Tunica. You know, Tunica is like right 15 minutes from us. It's in Mississippi. It's across the state line. And so in my head, I was like, Tunica, you know, we're finna send you anywhere you want to go. But once she explained to me why she wanted to go to Tunica, me and her was just crying on the phone. She beat breast cancer once before. She got pregnant with twins. Hormones feeds cancer. So her breast cancer came back. The doctor advised her that she's going to have an abortion or stop her chemo. She stopped her chemo to take her babies to term. During birth, she lost one lived and one passed. And she went back to start chemo. It had spread from her breast to her liver, to her lung, to her brain. Mm. And so they put her on hospice. And she said during the 2 years that she was carrying the baby, and the 2 years she was suffering from cancer, and her kids have saw her lose weight, lose her hair. She said every Friday before she got sick, she used to take her kids to eat crab legs as a reward. If they did their homework and cleaned the house or cleaned the room without her asking, she took them to the casino to eat crab legs. Like they knew Friday they were going to eat. And she said, I hadn't been able to do that for 2 years for my children. She said, I want to have that experience one more time before I die. So I contacted Horseshoe Casino. They sent the limo. Memphis Police Department sent 15 motorcycles, police motorcycles.
Oh, wow.
Tunica County Sheriff sent 15 squad cars, and they escorted her through the city of Memphis, her and her children and her mom, her fiance, like they were the president of the United States, taking them on the wrong side of the road, blocking every intersection. Her kids got to see her so happy. She was so grateful for that wish. And so that's why we do what we do. And after she went, had her wish, the lobby was packed full of supporters clapping and cheering for her. She went back to chemo and she fought and she lived 5 more months and she died Memorial Day this past year.
Oh, wow. That's an incredible story, man. You're doing some really great things. All right, before I let you go, I need for you to share with me where the people can find Pink at What You Think and have access to you and some of the things that you're doing.
Well, you can locate us on Facebook at Pink Ain't What You Think. We also have a web page, pinkainwhatyouthink.com. We are seeking community partners and corporate partners to keep this work going. Each cremation service costs about $3,000 per cremation service. So that takes a chunk out of the budget. So, but you can find us again at pinkainwhatyouthink.com. Or if you want to donate to Pink Ain't What You Think, it's going to be Cash App, $, Pink Ain't What You Think. Venmo is Pink Ain't What You Think. And PayPal is that Pink Ain't What You Think. Our address here at Pink Ain't What You Think is Pink Ain't What You Think, P.O. Box 613-409, Memphis, Tennessee, 38101. Again, that's P.O. Box 613-409, Memphis, Tennessee, 38101. And we look forward to partnering with you so that we can continue this great work.
Excellent. Vance, tremendous story. Thank you for stopping by here today. I really appreciate you sharing that with us.
Thank you very much for the invite. I've enjoyed this. And if you need me again, please don't hesitate to reach out, sir.
Will do.
Thanks for listening to Leave Your Mark today. Tune into our next episode of Leave Your Mark with Vince Cortez. Be blessed.
You just left your mark. Thanks for listening. Listen to more episodes on demand. Just click Leave Your Mark with Vince Cortez.